Like the other speakers, I want to thank the organizers, Matt and Haynes and Mike and, of course, Jack, for inviting me here and giving me the opportunity to speak. Happy birthday, Jack. And I've known Jack actually my whole career, but in the last 5 years or so, I think our mathematical interests have coincided a bit more, so I've gotten to know him a bit more. And it's really been fun. I mean, many of you have had the opportunity to talk to Jack about mathematics, and those of you who haven't, go see him after the talk. It's really great fun. And the other thing I want to observe is, you know, the breadth of topics covered in this conference, I think, is amazing. And I think it's a testament to Jack's own breadth of mathematical interests, which is something I really admire. But anyway, enough of these nice things. I don't want it to go to your head, Jack. So I thought I'd do something concrete. I know a lot of us are taking a week off of teaching undergraduates, so I thought I'd start with some calculus. So let MD be a smooth manifold, a closed smooth manifold. And usually oriented. Consider the cotangent space, cotangent bundle. So this object has come up in a couple different talks. I want to think of it as a manifold in its own right, the 2D dimensional manifold. And it comes equipped with obviously a projection map. And I want to differentiate that projection map. And I want to keep track of the points. So a point in the cotangent space, I want to think of as a pair. So x is a point in the manifold, and y is an element in the cotangent space at x. And I can, let me just go over here, I can take the tangent space at that point of the cotangent bundle, and I differentiate that projection map, and I end up in the tangent space at x of the manifold. And now y, being an element of the cotangent space, is a linear function on the tangent space, so I can compose it with y and get a real number. And I get a linear function on the tangent space of the cotangent bundle. So I'll give that a name, alpha of xy. So alpha of xy, or alpha, is a one form. On this cotangent bundle, viewed as a manifold. So I can differentiate it. And this two-form turns out to be a symplectic two-form, non-degenerate, skew-symmetric form on the tangent bundle of the cotangent bundle. It's hard to keep these words straight. So the cotangent bundle of a manifold has a canonical symplectic structure, just essentially by differentiating the projection map. Well, whenever you have a symplectic manifold, there exists many almost complex structures. In fact, compatible almost complex structures. So this means a complex structure on the tangent bundle of the cotangent bundle. So in other words, you have an operator at the on the tangent space to itself whose square is minus the identity. And by compatible, I mean that if I look at the form on the tangent space, so if I take two vectors in the tangent space, then if I look at the form defined by taking the symplectic form on U and J of V, then this defines a Riemannian metric. And so when you have such a compatible J with a symplectic structure, you can study J holomorphic curves. And Gromov-Witten theory is essentially the subject of studying J holomorphic curves on a symplectic manifold. And so the goal of a project that I've been working on for some time now is to try to understand the Gromov-Witten theory, in other words, symplectic curves, holomorphic curves in the cotangent bundle, in terms of string topology, which again has come up several times in the lectures this week so far, which has to do with the loop space of the manifold, sort of the differential topology of the loop space of the manifold. Okay. So the technique or the idea of the technique is something that is an idea that I pursued quite a long time ago, 12, 13 years ago. It only got so far. A student of mine wrote a nice thesis on it. And the idea is the following. So the idea is to get construct a simpler model, or a simpler, maybe I should say analog, of Gromov-Witten theory in general, with the following kinds of data. So the idea is to replace sort of the ingredients in Gromov-Witten theory by ingredients in a simpler theory. So I want to replace a surface by a graph, gamma. And by a graph, I just mean a one-dimensional CW complex, finite. Now, there's lots of data associated to the surface that goes into Gromov-Witten theory. I want to, the notion of the genus is taken over by the notion of the Betti number, so the rank of H1. In the surface, you often consider marked points on the surface, distinguished points. In the graph, these will be replaced by univalent vertices. Sometimes called leaves. So these guys. What else? A complex structure on the surface. Well, up to isomorphism, these things are conformal classes of metrics on the surface. And so I'm just going to replace that notion by a metric on the graph, basically giving each edge a length. What else? The Cauchy-Riemann equations. And this is, in some sense, the most important thing. The Cauchy-Riemann equations, are, of course, a system of partial differential equations. So I'm going to replace them by something that's analytically much easier. And in an appropriate sense, they will just be the gradient flow equations of a function, usually a Morse function, on a target manifold. And so that's an ordinary differential equation. The analysis is much, much easier. So in particular, a holomorphic curve, sort of the basic object of studying Gromov-Witten theory, so from a surface to the target symplectic manifold, in the case we're interested in, it's a cotangent bundle, is going to be replaced by something that I call a graph flow, which is a map from my graph to the target manifold. that has the property that the restriction to each edge is an appropriate gradient trajectory of a function on the manifold. So again, replacing maps that satisfy a PDE by maps that satisfy ODE. Now, in describing this all, I'm going to use techniques of Culler and Grotman, geometric topology, also of Igusa, and also I get to steal techniques from my now former student, Veronique Godin. So let me just get started. Oh, and I should say that originally this work was pursued by a former student of mine, Marty Betts, and then it was really expanded on and made into a beautiful theory by Fukaya. And the present stuff that I'm going to talk about is joint work with Paul Norbury, who's from Melbourne. Okay, so let me just get started. I want to define a category of graphs. So I'll let C, B, T plus Q be a category where the objects are graphs and again, finite one-dimensional CW complexes with B1 of the rank of the first homology group is B. It will have some other properties. Let me try to get a picture going here. Same picture. It'll have oriented edges. So just arrows on the edges. And it'll have P plus Q univalent vertices. These leaves. P of them, I think of as incoming, the ones with the arrows going in toward the graph. And Q outgoing. And I want to add one extra bit of data. I want a base point V, which is a vertex that's going to be kept along for the ride. So say here, it's not one of the univalent vertices. Okay. So what are the morphisms? So a morphism from one to the other is first of all a cellular map that has the following properties. The inverse image of any vertex is a tree, in other words, contractible subgraph. And the inverse image of a given edge, open edge, is just a given edge. These two conditions together mean that phi is a homotopy equivalent. I want phi to preserve orientation. That's pretty much it, except I want it to preserve the base point as well. So that's what I mean by a morphism in this category. Now, for a fixed graph, we'll really want to focus our attention on one graph, for a fixed graph gamma, I want to define the category C gamma to be these graphs over gamma. So this is the usual thing that one does. An object is a map or a morphism here whose target is gamma, and a morphism between two such things is just a morphism between gamma 0 and, say, gamma 1 that makes this diagram commute. Now, in some sense, this is not a very interesting category because, as you can see, when I write these sort of absolute value signs, I mean the geometric realization of the category, this is contractible. And that's because C gamma has a terminal object. So, namely the identity. Which essentially will mean that the geometric realization is a cone. But the automorphism group, and by that I mean the isomorphisms of gamma to itself in that category, acts freely. So on the category. And so in particular, if I mod out by the automorphism group, of course, I get a model for the classifying space. So it's interesting from that perspective. And more than that, I want to think of this space as, in some sense, a moduli space. And I'll try to argue that. In particular, I want to think of this as a space of metrics. Sort of grammatically you would say on, but you'll see in a moment, I really want to say over gamma. So a point in this geometric realization will be a metric, roughly speaking, will be a metric on gamma. So let me say why to think of it that way. Yeah, so, well, gamma has a P and a Q associated to it. So, yeah, so the same P's and Q's. Right. Okay, so how do I think of this as a metric? Let me look at the realization of the category before dividing by the automorphism group. So, of course, this is just you take a K-simplex for every K-tuple of morphism. And, of course, this lives over gamma. So it's really determined by this last one. So a point in this is a point in the simplex together with that. And what is this? This is, for example, suppose my graph is, here's an example of a two-simplex. So I'll take this kind of tadpole graph. So C2, for example, can collapse B. So remember, the morphisms here can collapse trees to a point. And that's basically all they can do. And C1 will, say, collapse D to a point. And then I'll just think of this as the identity. So that's a two-simplex. Now if I take a point in delta 2, how do I think of that as giving a metric? Well, the objects in the sequence of morphism, of course, are the correspond to the vertices. So I'll put this guy up here, CD. And here I give all the edges have equal length. Say equal to 1. or maybe you want to normalize it in some way. At this vertex, you have the next one. So here, CD. And if you look at along this face of the two simplex, here the what's happening is that the length of D, which is being collapsed, goes from 1 to 0. It shrinks along that edge. And in this vertex, we have this guy, I guess, C and A. And here, D shrinks. So a typical point in the simplex will be some weighted sum of what's happening to the edges here. So such a thing gives you a length. So a point in this gives you a length of each edge of the biggest graph that lies over gamma. So in some sense, you get a metric on a graph that is a subdivision of the original thing. So that's why I wanted to say these are metrics over gamma, because you're allowed to sort of subdivide and then give length to the edges. And then the length can go to zero. This is not unlike the trees that we saw Michael talk about on Monday. Okay. So right now I have these lengths, and as I said before, I want to label these edges not only by length by giving them a metric, but I want to label by functions, Morse functions, by distinct functions. Fi. From the fixed background manifold to the real numbers. So how do I do this formally? Well, I consider a functor, mu, a labeling functor. Mu stands for Morse, from this category of graphs over gamma to spaces, that sends a graph gamma naught over gamma to all the labeling of its edges. So that's a configuration space of points in the vector space of smooth functions on the manifold. And how many points are there? Well, it's the number of edges of gamma zero. So these are distinct points. So this gives you labels of these edges by distinct functions. Okay, so I want to include all this data, so homotopy theoretically, how would you do it? You just define, by the way, I call such a thing a Morse labeling. So I define the space of structures on the graph is defined to be the homotopy colimit of this functor. Well, all right, so not everybody is familiar with this. What does this mean? Well, the way to think about it, or at least the way I think of this is the space of pairs, sigma, well, let me say it this way, a metric and a Morse labeling on a graph over gamma. So essentially on a subdivided version of gamma. So this is my space of structures. So this is my space of, this is the structure space that I'm going to deal with. And in some sense, this is my analog of the Teichmuller space. This is the space of metrics, like Teichmuller space can be viewed as. Strictly speaking, I suppose it's a little bit more analogous to space of metrics on a surface together with a choice of almost complex structure on the target because we're including some data from the target, these choices of function. So the basic moduli space that we're going to be studying, M gamma M, well, let me just write M gamma, is defined to be the space of structures up to automorphism. So this will take the role of the space of Riemann surfaces. No. Generically, they'll be Morse, but it's just like the space of almost complex structures. If you choose a bad one, you're out of luck. But with respect to a generic one, you have nice properties. Right. And again, this is homotopy equivalent to the classifying space of this automorphism group. And this is somewhat analogous to the idea, at least when you have boundary components, that the moduli space of Riemann surfaces is equivalent to classifying space of the diffeomorphism group of the surface. So what takes the role of holomorphic curves? So I want to talk about the moduli space of graph flows. Well, first of all, I'll put a tilde on it, which means before I divide out by automorphism. This is just going to be the space of pairs, sigma gamma, where sigma is a structure. So remember what that means. You have this subdivision of gamma. You have a metric on it, and you have a labeling of each of the edges by function. And so that's all included in that symbol gamma, and sigma, rather, sorry. And this is a map from the graph to the manifold, which is a gradient flow on each edge. So it satisfies the following ODEs. I'll tell you exactly what I mean by this in just a second. But the derivative of gamma I, which is essentially the restriction to the I's edge, is equal to minus the gradient flow of the function that labels the I's edge. So now, so remember, the structure gives us length, and it also gives us functions. So that's all part of this data. Now, let me say specifically, the orientations of the edges plus the metric determine parameterization of each edge. By the way, I'm sorry. This is a map from gamma k, which is, remember, we had this sequence of a point in this moduli, in this space of structures, has a sequence of morphisms, and gamma k is the last object appearing, so the most subdivided, if you like. Okay, so the orientations and metric determine parameterization from some interval, Li, which is the length of the edge, to whatever edge is in your graph. And so gamma I is really a map from the interval to the manifold, and it satisfies this differential equation. Roughly speaking, you know, you have some manifold here. What you're doing is you're flowing along the gradient flow of this function, F1, for time L1. It's not really time. It's really determined by the length, but the time is a function of the length. So that's how you think of this. Now, because these are ordinary differential equations, we can say something about these moduli spaces that are about the global topology. So, for example, here's a theorem, which is quite easy, that says if gamma is a tree, so if it's contractible, then the space, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't quite finish. M gamma n is just M tilde modulo the automorphism group. So the statement of the theorem is that if gamma is a tree, M gamma m is actually homeomorphic to this moduli space of structures, of metrics and Morse labelings on the graph across the manifold. And the homeomorphism is given by sending a structure and a graph flow to the structure and the value of the graph flow at the fixed point, the base point, vertex. Now, why is this a homeomorphism? Well, again, well, consider this graph, for example. It's a tree, and we have lengths and we have functions. So let me just put down the functions, labeling it. And we have a map to manifold. Say this is our vertex V, the base point. So if we tell ourselves where the vertex goes in the manifold, then it completely determines the flow, because you have to flow by, this is a gradient trajectory of F1 for time L1, and so on, F2 and F3. It's completely determined. That is to say, what are we using? We're using the only theorem in differential equations I know, and I just learned it last spring when I taught the darn thing, is it follows from existence and uniqueness. Which, of course, you don't have for PDEs. Now, you can say something, and here's where some interesting homotopy theory comes in. You can say something in a general situation when you don't necessarily have a tree. So, gamma in general graph. What can you say? Well, first of all, I want to define. I really like these trees, so I'll define a tree moduli space of flows, maybe M tree gamma M, and I'll tell you what I mean. This is also pairs sigma gamma, where again sigma is in this is a structure on gamma, a metric and a Morse labeling. This gamma, I sorry about the use of these letters gamma. I don't know that many Greek letters, so I just keep with the few I know. Here, gamma is a collection. Unlike before, it's a collection, gamma t. I'll tell you what I mean by that. So gamma t is a flow from a tree to the manifold, so a graph flow, where t is a maximal subtree. Oops, gamma is a maximal subtree. And so this collection is taken over all maximal trees inside gamma. So the picture is like this tadpole again. So here's gamma. I might have a subtree that looks like this. So that edge has been removed. And so I have a flow, not from all of gamma, but I have a flow, gamma t, to m. And I have such a thing for any subtree, for any maximal tree. Oh, and, you know, right now they're just an arbitrary collection. They have the only property that they have to satisfy is that they take the base point to the same point. So if that's v, we'll say gamma t of v is equal to gamma t prime of v for any pair t and t prime. So they take the base point to the same point. And the same argument, existence and uniqueness, shows that this space, again, is homeomorphic to m across this moduli space, which again, remembering, is homotopy equivalent to M cross the classifying space of the group. So what's the theorem about this? So the theorem is that the moduli space M gamma M of all graph flows sits inside the tree moduli space, which again is homeomorphic to M cross the moduli space of structures, and it sits inside by just sending a structure gamma to, well, same notation. Well, I'll write it this way, where gamma T is just the restriction of gamma. And the theorem is that this is a codimension D, which is the dimension, well, let me write it out, the dimension of the manifold times the rank, the Betti number, the rank of the homology class, that has that codimension. So you might wonder what I mean by this, because I've said nothing about the manifold structure of any of these spaces. These are geometric realizations of categories. I've avoided that as best I could. So what do I mean by a codimension something embedding? Well, what I mean is sort of a homotopy theoretic version of that, which is to say there exists a homotopy Cartesian square, pullback square, vibration, from this tree moduli space, whose topology we know, to a product of the manifold with itself a bunch of times. And it's two times the Betti number, B1 of gamma. But I want to write it as M squared to that. I'll tell you what roughly what this map is in a moment. And inside here, I just want to look at M to the B1 of gamma, where this is the diagonal from M to M squared this many times. So that's a diagonal embedding of this codimension. And then the moduli space sits up here. So it fibers over an honest codimension something embedding is what I mean by that. Let me just sort of draw a picture of what this map is. I'm going to assume the Betti number is 1 in this picture. So, you know, in that case, a maximal tree is, I'll do the same one I've been drawing, is what you get by removing an appropriate edge. But that edge is still there, or at least its memory is there. The ghost of that edge is there. And so the obvious thing you can do is let's take the vertex, or one of the vertices, of the edge that's gone. And we have gamma t to m. So the first thing we do is look at gamma t, let's give that a name, say u, gamma t of u. So that's a point in m. But the other thing we could do is not only is that edge in our memory, but so is its length and a function that labels it. That's all part of our memory here. And so we could have started here and flew along this edge for the time given by the length of that edge according to the gradient flow of the function that labels that edge. And you could see where you end up by going that way. So I'll just call it gamma t ghost of u. And we get two numbers. And clearly, this is the restriction of an honest flow line if and only if these two numbers are the same. And so that's where this Cartesian square comes in. All of the categorical stuff, being really careful about how these structure spaces are defined, was in order to make this a fibration so that I knew that this was a Cartesian, homotopy Cartesian square. Now, what does that buy you? So doing this little bit of homotopy theory saves you a bunch of analysis in the following way. This suffices to define a Pontryagin-Thom collapse map. Tau sub E that takes this tree moduli space to the full moduli space, but the Thom space of its normal bundle. Well, what is its normal bundle from a Cartesian square? It's just the pullback of the normal bundle of that diagonal. I'll just write it that way. So you get a Thom space. And that allows you, in turn, to define a shriek map, or an Umkehr map, as Jim McClure called it. I like the term shriek, or as Jack taught me, he calls it, or at least I heard him in a lecture call it, just simply a surprise map. That you write a shriek symbol because you're sort of surprised it exists, I guess. And I'm going to put a little h because I want to point out that you could do this in any homology theory. Well, in fact, we know what the homology is here. So this is the homology of M cross the automorphism group to the homology with the dimension shift of this codimension of M, of this moduli space. And H could be any multiplicative homology theory that supports an orientation of the manifold. You need to be able to do the Thom isomorphism with this Thom space. So everything I'm going to say can work in this generality for homology, these generalized homology theories, but I'm just going to phrase it in terms of ordinary homology. So what does that Umkehr map buy for us? That buys for us the notion of a virtual fundamental class. So this we can define a virtual fundamental class in the following way. Now, one thing, you know, you think virtual fundamental class or fundamental class, that's the top dimensional homology class of a manifold. Well, this manifold is infinite dimensional because it's a finite codimension submanifold of M cross something which is homotopy equivalent to the classifying space of a finite group, infinite dimensional. So you have to cut this down. Cut down the classifying space, and the natural way to cut it down is by a homology class. So let N, and I'm going to write it there to give the idea that this is represented by a manifold, but it really could be any homology class in the automorphism group. Then I want to define the virtual fundamental class M N of gamma M to be the image under the shriek map of the fundamental class of M cross N. And so this is in the homology of this space of graph flows. Now, where does this come from? Where is the idea for this? The idea, of course, the more geometric idea, is you would like to think of M, if N tilde, say, is a submanifold of the space of structures, and it's, say, equivariant, so that N is N tilde modulo of the automorphism group, then you would like to define the moduli space MN gamma M to be the space of pairs, a structure, and a flow with respect to that structure, such that sigma lies in N. But then you have obvious geometric questions. Is this, so this is not finite dimensional, or should be finite dimensional. So you have obvious geometric questions. Is this a manifold? And for a long time, they're trying to prove that with a generic choice of n, it is a manifold. And it's probably right, but it didn't, could never do that. And then you have questions about compactness. The smoothness has to do with questions about transversality of the linearized operator that defines the moduli space. And then you have questions about compactness. And these are typical questions in all of Gromov-Witten type theories that you have to deal with. And so if the answer is yes, or, you know, if you can compactify in a reasonable way, then you can define a virtual fundamental class. That's the way this is usually done in honest Gromov-Witten theory. Well, we've avoided that. I have no idea. I mean, I think the answers to these questions are yes, but I don't know how to prove them. But we've avoided it by just defining this Umkehr map from that little bit of homotopy theory. By the way, the existence of these tome collapse maps and the Umkehr maps for this sort of general situation was originally observed by Hatcher and Quinn in a paper in the late 70s, which is really quite nice. Jones and I, in a paper on string topology, also sort of realized that you could do this. And sort of the general theory has been worked out by John Klein using sort of a modern category of spectra. Anyway, so you can do that. So now you can play the Gromov-Witten game here. Yeah? Yeah, it's in any homology theory you can do this. Yeah. Oh, no, then, I mean, in honest Gromov-Witten theory, you have orbifold situations when you talk about smoothness, so you only get rational classes. But here, the situation is easier. Here you get integral classes or classes in any homology theory that for which the manifold is orientable. Okay, now, so what is this Gromov-Witten game? Well, the usual thing you do is you take your moduli space of curves, or in our case, these graph flows, and you evaluate at the marked points. Now, I'm going to actually just work up it, prior to dividing out by the automorphism group for a minute. And so the marked points, remember, on this graph mean these univalent vertices. And so you have m to the p cross m to the q. There are p plus q points. And then the usual thing you do, you know, analytically, the idea is you take differential forms on here, pull them back over here, and integrate. So, of course, what that means is you evaluate on the fundamental class. So you can do that. So you can pull back cohomology classes and evaluate on the virtual fundamental class and for any homology class n. And the upshot is when you do this and you check out equivariance, you end up with operations from the homology of the automorphism group, because if we could do this for every n homology class, tensor the homology of m p times, and you can actually do this in equivariant homology m p times, symmetric group acting, to the equivariant homology of m q times. So you get operations like that. And they respect gluing of graphs and the morphisms in this graph category when you let gamma vary. So it's a field theory in the sense that Constantine was telling us about on Monday, analog of what he called, I think, a homological conformal field theory, except nothing's conformal here. Anyway, just an analogy. Just as an example, if I take this graph oriented this way, so there's one incoming point and two outgoing points, then this Q gamma is a map from the homology. Well, first of all, what is the automorphism group? It's just Z2. It's flip these things is all you can do. This takes the homology of RP infinity tensor, the homology of M, to the equivariant homology of M cross M. And this is the equivariant diagonal. It's not hard to see that. That Steenrod originally studied when he defined Steenrod squares. And what's kind of cool about this story is that from this perspective, if you use this gluing formulas and this naturality, you can prove the Cartan formulas and the Adem relations and all of that stuff from this perspective as well. I've talked about those operations in a lot of different contexts, and many of you have heard me talk about it, so I don't think I'll go into it anymore, but I want to spend my remaining time talking about loop spaces. So now we want to talk about loop spaces. And we want to do the same kind of thing, except we need a good supply of Morse functions. It's infinite dimensional, so you don't have as ready a supply, but there are loads of them. And the way we'll come by them is from sort of classical mechanics. So I'll consider functions from the circle, which I think of as R mod Z cross M to R. So these are potential functions. And this defines an energy function, classical mechanics, SV, of a loop. Namely, you take a loop and you look at the total energy, kinetic plus potential energy. So the kinetic energy is 1/2 mass times the velocity squared. So assume mass is 1, 1/2 times the derivative, the length of the derivative squared. And then plus the potential energy, V of t, gamma of t, and then I integrate the whole thing over the circle. So that's the total energy. This is the kind of thing Morse himself studied. In particular, when V is the zero function, the critical points are closed geodesics, Morse studied. It turns out that for a generic V, SV is Morse in a very strong sense, in the sense that isolated critical points that are non-degenerate, it satisfies the Pallet-Smale condition, in the sense, which means that if you have an infinite sequence of points where the gradient goes to zero, then there's a subsequence that converges to a critical point. It also satisfies the Morse-Smale condition, which says that the unstable and stable manifolds intersect each other transversely. So it's as nice as possible, and in particular for our purposes, the upshot is there exists a CW complex, homotopy equivalent to the loop space. And in particular, you have the cellular chain. So, and of course, there's one cell for every critical point. So you have the cellular chains that I'll write like this that computes the homology of the loop space with respect to one of these potentials. Well, what can you do? If I really went through the same procedure with these Morse functions, then I would get the classical operations like Steenrod squares for the Morse function. For these loop spaces, which isn't what we want to do. We want to do something a little different. So we use fat graphs. So fat graphs have been studied for quite a while in Riemann surface theory. I think the term was coined by Penner. What these are graphs, let's draw a picture of one, where you have a couple extra conditions. Each vertex is at least trivalent, and it comes equipped with a cyclic ordering of the edges at each vertex, part of the data. So I drew it this way to denote the cyclic ordering, 1, 2, 3, 4, of the edges of that vertex, using the counterclockwise orientation of the plane. And when you have this, and I'll say this a little bit more precisely in just a second, you can thicken it, and you get a surface. It's essentially what this thickening is that you remember the fact that when you draw these graphs, the chalk has some width to it. So you're really drawing a surface, not a one-dimensional thing. That's all the thickening means. And you get a surface. In this case, it looks like this. So in this case, the genus is 1, and the number of boundary components is 2. And the theorem that Bob proved, and also there are various sort of versions of this, Strabo, others, is that the space of metric fat graphs of a given topological type, Gn, where G is the genus and N is the number of boundary components, is homotopy equivalent to moduli space M, G. I'm going to put an N up there. I don't know if this is standard or not. Where this is Riemann surfaces, moduli space of Riemann surfaces, complex one-dimensional manifolds, genus G, and N marked points. Now, I'm going to need a little bit of extra data to do this game. And so the extra data is something that Veronique worked out. And I don't know if this is her terminology or not, but I call it a boundary marking. She'll talk about this more in her lecture tomorrow. But when you add this data, you get a space homotopy equivalent to the moduli space MGN with the N down here, where this is the number of parameterized boundary components. Bob and Ralph Kaufman have a different model for this moduli space, similar but a bit different. And the upshot for my purposes is that there exists parameterization of these circles, of these boundaries, which I'll call alpha plus minus to gamma. So the plus meaning alpha on P of the incoming circles, that's alpha plus. On Q of the outgoing circles, it's alpha minus. So you have these parameterizations. So for example, for this graph, for the figure 8 graph, there's 3 boundary circles, these 2 circles independently, and then the pinch circle, which you can, because this thickens to a surface with 3 boundary components. Well, when you do that, you can define a surface, sigma gamma, which is a topological surface, and in the following way. You have a bunch of cylinders, P of them, say, S of half cylinders that go from minus infinity to 0 for the incoming boundary circles. You have Q half circles, but parameterized by S1 cross 0 positive infinity. And then they're put together at time 0 along gamma, along the combinatorics of gamma by alpha. Usual kind of usual mapping cylinder. So the picture in this case of this figure 8 is you have this sort of infinite cylinders. So this is negative infinity to 0. And then you have a very rigid pair of pants, lots of starch. I want to think of this kind of graph as the analog in this theory of that graph. Because Well, you know, a curve in the manifold, in the loop space, is a cylinder in the manifold. It's just they're glued together in some sense that the data that you have in finite dimensions is blown up. I don't know how to say this precisely, but that's certainly the intuition, that you take these graphs and the fat graph stuff is the transversal blow-up data. Well, time is running very short. You know, remember, I don't know if it was a lecture of Jack's or not, but I remember hearing a lecture once, and the person said, boy, the time sure goes by a lot faster up here than it does down there. And that certainly is true. But anyway, so if we do the same kind of game now, labeling the edges by Morse functions requires us now to label the boundary cylinders by function. And we'll label them by the kinds of Morse functions we've studied, which is now off the board, but these energy functions. So a loop space Morse structure on gamma is a metric on the fat graph. This all can be done in categorical language, but it's also a labeling of each boundary cylinder by a potential, which is equivalent to labeling it by the function defined by that potential, the energy function defined by the potential. So just label these V1, V2, V3, for example. These are different functions. So I can look at my moduli space. So given such a structure, call it sigma again, the moduli space with respect to that structure in the loop space is the set of all maps, in this case, from the surface, this topological surface to M, because this can be viewed as paths in the loop space that fit together according to the combinatorial data determined by the fat graph, which is a gradient flow line on each boundary. And you play the same game, or similar game, I should say, and this leads to operations Q gamma, from the homology of the space of all of these structures, which by Penner's theorem is moduli space, or Veronique's adaptation of it, moduli space of genus N and genus G and N boundary components, tensor the homology of the loop space N times, and the homology of the loop space, P times, N is P plus Q, to the homology of the loop space Q times. By the way, when G equals 0, this is the same as the homology of the framed little disk operad that Jim was talking about. And a theorem that student Antonio worked out, Antonio Ramirez, is that these are the string topology operations. That were initiated by Chass and Sullivan and generalized in different ways. So you have all of this structure. And this is a way of thinking of those. Now, time is up, but let me spend 1 minute talking about the cotangent bundle and relating it. And I'll just have to summarize this very, very quickly by saying there is work in the last few years by several people. Viterbo had the first proof of this, and the analytic version that we need was done by Solomon and Weber, that says if you take one of these functions, these V's, these potential functions, and define a Hamiltonian, HV, just a new function on the circle across the cotangent bundle by just sending T and XY to, you just take the length of Y, I think half of it, plus the value of the potential. Then the floor homology. That Kapranov talked about yesterday, for the cotangent bundle with the canonical symplectic structure with respect to this kind of Hamiltonian, of this cotangent bundle is actually isomorphic to the homology of the loop space as a vector space. And that comes from this symplectic action that Kapranov talked about has the same critical points, or they're in bijective correspondence, is that energy function SV. And in proving this, what they show are that there's a correspondence. It's really a cobordism between the gradient flow lines of the energy function and holomorphic cylinders in the cotangent bundle, which is used to compute floor homology. So the upshot is the following, and then I'll quit. So it's a theorem that came about from joint discussions with Eli Ashberg, that you can consider the space of flow of pairs sigma phi, where sigma is a structure again, is a LM structure. So it's a sort of a labeling on a fat graph gamma. It's a metric and a Morse labeling. And phi is a map from the cylinder to the cotangent bundle, which is J holomorphic on each cylinder. So call this M a different moduli space, sort of the cylindrical holomorphic curves. So it's mapped from this kind of rigid surface to the cotangent bundle that are holomorphic on each cylinder, then the result is that, in some sense, this is cobordant to the space before. So really what I want to say is that you can use these moduli spaces rather than the spaces of gradient flows like we did before to define these string topology operations Q gamma. So there is this correspondence between a field theory coming in floor homology from counting holomorphic, these sort of cylindrical holomorphic curves, and string topology. And in particular, a special case of this, in the case of the graph, or the figure 8 graph, so we have this rigid pair of pants again, is that the pair of pants product in floor homology of the cotangent bundle, which is what Kapranov referred to as a quantum product. I'm not sure that name really is so appropriate in this setting, but whatever, is isomorphic to the Chass-Sullivan product in the loop space. And I think, so this is, in my opinion, just sort of the beginning, because I think what it says is that if you study the space of holomorphic curves in the cotangent bundles that are very thin, Witten talked about this, thin from thin Riemann surfaces with cylindrical ends, and you do Gromov-Witten theory, or in the full in its full flavors, including symplectic field theory, contact homology, and all of that, that should really correspond to string topology in its full flavors, including open-closed string topology and all of that. So I really think there's a correspondence, which, if true, would, I think, be quite exciting because, Gromov-Witten theory or floor homology is basically dependent on Morse theory, which is very important for a geometric perspective. But, generally, Morse theory isn't such a good way of computing, where algebraic topology has loads of good computational methods. So getting this relationship straight, I think, is a very interesting thing that's just beginning now. Okay, thanks.